This is the Criminal Law Revision Commission, Subcommittee Number 3, Thursday, January 22, 1970, 1:30 p.m., Room 315, City Capitol Building. Today's subject, offenses involving narcotics and dangerous drugs, PD Number 2, offenses involving firearms and weapons, PD Number 1.
Paragraph Number 2, which hopefully does, well, maybe, Mr. Chairman, before we get to that, maybe we ought to dispose of our minutes on December 11th.
I move we dispose of them.
Right.
Yeah,
they're disposed.
Disposed of.
But hopefully this preliminary draft number 2 does everything on narcotics that the subcommittee wanted done at the meeting of December 11th. And I thought we could just have Roger go through it. I don't think, unless you've got some questions about any individual sections, it'd be necessary to go through it word by word again.
Especially since Roger probably can't pronounce half the words in the third line.
No, yeah. I'm not. It'd be fun to hear him try them.
I think that's pronounced Harris.
Has this list been checked?
Did yes, you check it with since the last meeting, mm-hmm. There were no changes made.
Hello, Jack. What brings you into this den of iniquity? We'll try not to.
I have a question on sub C. Does the language here solve the Josephine County problem or prevent it from arising again?
No. No, that's mentioned in the commentary.
Yeah, I noticed.
You mean insofar as any drugs that might be designated as dangerous in the future? No, it doesn't.
No, that's just strictly the same language that the statute now has, isn't it?
But since the Drug Advisory Council is the only group with authority to designate these drugs as dangerous, I see no way to avoid that potential problem.
Hi, Don.
Hello, Don. You still a Meyer and Frank bumper shoot?
Portland State University football umbrella.
Oh,
I thought that was the Rainmaker.
No
way of doing it then.
No, and the other potential problem could be that the Drug Advisory Council might someday in the future delete one of the specified drugs as being dangerous, in which case I assume the next legislative assembly would amend Section 1, and relying on the good discretion of the prosecutors, they wouldn't prosecute for possession of that particular dangerous drug in the interim.
You're in trouble two places. Number one, the wisdom of the legislature, and number two, the discretion of the prosecutor. I don't know which one scares me worse.
Yeah, they're equal. Okay.
Well, of course you could say that.
But I don't think the only way we can get around that problem, Josephine County problem, is by changing that statute that deals with the procedure.
Well, that's not really our bad anyway.
And that would be another section of it.
The second problem probably could be codified here with some provision that if a drug is deleted by the Drug Advisory Council is...
Would that be constitutional?
I don't know.
Okay. Would it be constitutional to let the Drug Advisory Council take one of these out?
I wouldn't think so. I think you run in the process of an unlawful legislative delegation.
Yeah, I
have the same question about them adding it, but then
they've always seen
we've done it, so.
I so really don't think that there's anything that they would on this list they would find all of a sudden was did not come within that. And if there was, they could go to the legislature themselves and say that we feel that.
Okay. I also have a question on sub 5. You say unlawfully means in violation of any provision of 474, 475, or any other Oregon statute. But your commentary says, on page 3, right about the middle of the page, is defined to mean in violation of 474, 475, or any other Oregon statute governing narcotic or dangerous drug transactions. Now, is that... Does one mean more or less than the other?
No. As far as I know, all the statutes that govern narcotic or dangerous drug violations, transactions are in ORS chapters 474 and 475.
Do we need then the language or any other Oregon statute?
Now originally that read, that's where we had, originally we had some federal reference
to the federal law. At the present time, probably not, unless in the future there were some laws passed relating to narcotics that were not put in those two particular chapters.
Of course, you could achieve the same thing by saying means in violation of any provision of Oregon, of any Oregon statute.
Yeah, you don't really, you don't need both. I agree. I think that
we also should be included that we mean the violation of this chapter, whatever it's going to be.
Well,
no,
because the only place unlawfully is used is where I'm obtaining a drug unlawfully.
Section 2. I think Section 2.
Well, we have under Section 6, obtaining a person commits a crime of obtaining a drug unlawfully. Yeah.
It's used in most of the sections. Mm-hmm. Those two chapters are the only two chapters in the Oregon Code that set out lawful means of possessing narcotics, for example, or manufacturing or selling.
And six is merely the title, not the essence.
There, number subsection 4 has been amended, and we've starting with and on the second line, so that it conforms the definition of sales.
Mm-hmm.
In sale in ORS 474.
Well, I would sort of think that if sometime in the future somebody puts a narcotic provision in 476, let's say, or 589 or something, wouldn't it be up to the Legislative Council to pick that up and crank it into this deal here?
Yeah, it would.
Why don't we just say it means in violation of 474 or 475?
Well, I suppose you could take it a step further and say, is it even necessary to define unlawfully? Does that really help us, you think?
Well, the only problem is then we may be cranking in some federal regulations that we don't have any idea about.
Well, and furthermore, there's lawful ways to prescribe narcotics. Take Section 2. If you knowingly and unlawfully prescribe narcotics or administer it, if you're a doctor and unlawfully...
Yeah, right.
I would just leave out, I would move that we strike or any other Oregon statute from sub 5 of Section 1.
I'd go along with that, I guess.
Don, you have any feelings one way or another about that? All in favor of the motion, say aye.
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 Opposed? Carried. Anybody have any other comment or suggestion concerning Section 1? All in favor of passing Section 1, say aye.
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 Opposed? Carried.
Page 4, Section 2, and a subcommittee meeting on December 11th, it was decided to delete or in effect incorporate four sections that we had in preliminary draft number 1 into one section. In other words, we had 2 degrees of sale and 2 degrees of possession. And so we've done that in Section 2, and Section 2 is pretty much a restatement of the present law. The person commits a crime of criminal dealing in drugs if he knowingly and unlawfully manufactures, cultivates, transports, possesses, sells, prescribes, administers, dispenses, or compounds any narcotic or dangerous drug. The major change is that we've included narcotic and dangerous drugs in one section. They're in separate sections now, although they carry the same penalty.
Frank, have you had occasionally, your Portland courts had occasion to rule on the question of whether or not a buyer of a narcotic drug is an accomplice with the seller? As far as the corroborating of accomplice?
I don't recall any cases on it.
Well, when I was up arguing Tuesday, there was a case being argued from Lane County where the trial court there had ruled that the buyer was an accomplice, and then the defendant was appealing on the grounds that there wasn't sufficient corroboration. So whether the Court of Appeals will, the state was trying to get the Court of Appeals to reverse the trial court's ruling, in effect, on it being an accomplice. But the primary basis that the trial court had decided that they were an accomplice was a tradition you think of it. Can this other person be charged under the same statute? And of course, the buyer could not be charged with selling the narcotic drug, but it's under the same statute. Possession is under the same statute. So on that basis, the trial court ruled that even though the buyer might be charged with some other wording of the crime, that they're being charged under the same statute and is an accomplice as a matter of law.
Mm. And the state was arguing this?
The state was arguing that they were not an accomplice. But the trial court had already ruled that they were, and the appeal was on the grounds that there wasn't sufficient corroboration. So in effect, what the state was arguing was that, well, there is sufficient corroboration, but the trial court was wrong in its ruling, so there shouldn't have been necessary for any corroboration,
I see.
But the defendant, of course, was objecting to the state's backdoor appeal, and so what they were going to rule on, I don't know. But this is, I mean, I'm perfectly satisfied with the way it is here, except if the court does rule that the buyer is an accomplice, that this does create some problem.
Yeah, now, there aren't any Oregon cases I know of involving sale or narcotics, but there are some cases where you could argue by analogy, I think, that the buyer shouldn't be considered an accomplice on offering.
Right, I mean, and there are a number of states under similar statutes have ruled.
The Barnett case, for example, on abortion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but
you've got this State versus Coffee.
Yeah, but the Stanley and the Nice cases, which I just was looking at the other day, the sodomy cases, all say that the victim can be an accomplice. It's a question of fact whether he is, that he can be. Well,
yeah,
I was going to bring up, it occurred to me that you could have a purchaser who didn't have possession, and that it might be well to include purchase in the statute. I mean, suppose, for example, if I buy a baggie of marijuana from you, but I haven't yet come into possession of it.
You've got the intimate crimes there, though. You've got bus solicitation. Got a conspiracy, in effect.
Mm. Well, except for the Orr case, you could argue that, like, say, if you had, once I bought it from you and paid you the money for it, say, and rather than me picking it up, I had Roger go pick it up, that I was in constructive possession of it while Roger had it, at least, or while you were holding it for me.
Well, yeah,
under the Orr case, I don't know what he's coming in that or not. Anyway.
Would it hurt anything to put in purchase here?
Well, the problem, what it does, it makes the question of the buyer being an accomplice even more complicated than
that.
Yeah,
it really would, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Is that you're directly chargeable under the same statute, same transaction?
Well. Now, under our accomplice draft, you know, on parties to crime, we have a section in there on exemptions to criminal liability. And we've provided there that except as otherwise provided by the statute defining the crime, a person is not criminally liable for conduct of another constituting a crime if, one, he is a victim of that crime, or, two, the crime is so defined that his conduct is necessarily incidental thereto. And I would think the buyer would fall under sub 2 there, that his conduct would be incidental to the sale.
Mm-hmm. He could be charged with the possession. I mean, say if you weren't...
if you caught them both a minute after the transaction, you could... Mm-hmm. Catch the buyer on possession and the seller on sale.
Mm-hmm.
And in our commentary to that, we set out some of these Oregon cases and some of the model penal code discussion here. For they say no one can draft a prohibition of adultery without awareness that two parties to the conduct necessary will be involved. And it is proposed, therefore, that in such cases the general section on complicity be made inapplicable, leaving to the definition of the crime the selected judgment that must be made. If legislators know that buyers will not be viewed as accomplices in sales unless the statute indicates that his behavior is included in the prohibition, they will focus on the problem as they frame the definition of the crime. So it's precisely this kind of question that we're trying to get at there with that section. And,
well, then a buyer would not be an accomplice.
No, not under our
okay.
accomplices article.
Does that make the Hawks happy?
I don't think I like the method of defining the two sides.
That has a little color in it, doesn't it?
Now, if you wanted to just make it clear in this section, we might allude to our accomplices article in our commentary to this section if you wanted to do that.
I think that
would be a good deal to make it known that this is something that we did consider and felt that the accomplice court crime section would clearly make the buyer not a...
Inasmuch as we have not specifically provided for it.
Yeah. Well, why don't you put that in the commentary? Any other comment on section 2? All in favor of section 2?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried.
Why do we continue to use apothecary in the statute?
Because the definition statute uses it.
It's even worse.
That's your fault. That's legislature.
I ask the same thing. I don't.
Apothecary is like horribly old. That's like saying an amanuensis or a scribe or a scrivener.
We probably got amanuensis.
Yeah, we probably do.
I'm sure it's in there someplace. If
we had harassing.
Yeah, we knew. No, it's harassing.
No, but we had harassing.
What we're trying to do is make it manifest.
Now, this is a section we had a lot of discussion on December 11th, as I recall.
Section 3 on page 6. There have been, I believe, two additions, subsection 2 and 3.
This basically puts all together in one ball of wax the fooling around with prescriptions and records and so forth,
right.
And that was intended to do.
Yeah, this Section 3 restates a number of existing statutes. There's nothing new in it.
Have you really solved the problem of someone with a lawful prescription who takes the pill and puts it in a pill box, in a jewel pill box, the woman then throws it in her purse? Has she removed the drug label, or does this apply only to the receptacle in which the drug was sold?
Well, what we've done in another section, section 7, to make that prima facie evidence.
Oh.
That's what the present statute is. It makes it prima facie.
Well,
My father the other day was getting ready to go out of town, and he has a leather thing about this long, and he has 5 plastic bottles in it. Each one has a different kind of pill, no labels at all. And 3 of those 5 are prescription drugs. He carries them in large quantities.
That law hasn't been enforced too strictly.
Well, what it is, it relieves you of the burden when you, like say if they caught him with this. Now under those circumstances, they might feel that he had a prescription for them. But they could still, if the situation were there, go ahead and charge him. And then it would be up to him to show that he did have a prescription for these drugs.
That's a defense.
Mm-hmm.
In rereading ORS 474 today, we find that there's a section that requires you to return any unused portion of a narcotic drug.
That's unrealistic.
And that's punishable by 10 years imprisonment, $5,000 fine.
You mean if you...
If you fail to return any unused portion of a prescriptive narcotic.
That's ridiculous.
Now, I don't think that statute's been given a lot of attention.
That's the discretion of the prosecutor.
If he's a narc, he's going to have used it all up anyway. I mean,
of course. When does it become unused? I was just thinking last year when I was getting ready to go down to Nevada, I had a toothache and I had the dentist give me a whole bunch of codeine or whatever the imprint is. It's got a little bit of codeine and you need a prescription. Well, my tooth stopped hurting after I got down there a couple of days. So I stopped using the pills, but I may start again if it starts hurting.
The benefit where that statute would probably the only way that I can see it realistically being applied is where you have a person that is obtaining narcotics, like I just had a situation where they're getting desbutol in all different sorts of ways, and the guy did carry with him a valid prescription. And as I recall the situation, what he did have on him, he had some prescription drugs, and he did have a prescription. But probably the pills that he actually had there did not come under the prescription, because the way he used them, he would have had them all used up from that prescription. Of course, we had other charges that we were dealing with him, so I wasn't even concerned about this, but might have some
I guess we have to rely on prosecutorial discretion. I have a question about the commentary. In the first paragraph, you say, in most instances, the section applies both to narcotic and dangerous
drugs. That's correct. As a matter of fact, in all instances.
Yeah, and then you say, back in page 8, you say the narcotic drug marijuana would not ordinarily be within the scope of Section 3. Do we need to say that?
No.
Because
I wouldn't include that in our tentative draft.
Well, I suggest you take both those sentences out, because I don't think they... One, the first one, I think, is inaccurate.
It is.
In terms of...
Yeah, I caught that this morning.
Yeah, and then the last sentence there on page 8, I don't think it's necessary. I can't conceive of how 3 would apply to marijuana, but maybe it would, and if it would, let's don't cloud it up.
Well, subsection 4 might apply to marijuana. For research purposes, they keep reports and records in connection with marijuana.
But conceivably, marijuana could come to have a medical use.
Yes.
In which event, we'd want to cover forged prescriptions for it under sub 3. Any other questions on section 3?
Move it up.
All in favor of section 3, say aye.
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 Opposed? Carry.
Section 4, page 9. The only change we've made in this section, in subsection 1, beginning on line 3 with except, we've added that language, except for an administered or dispensed by or under direction of a person authorized by law.
What's that?
And that's taken out of the existing Oregon statute. Beginning here.
Well, that means that if I'm under the influence of morphine because the doctor gave me a shot, why, that's okay.
Mm-hmm. And we also deleted the reference to within the state.
Mm-hmm. Is subsection 2 a restatement of existing law?
Yes.
It's a restatement of the narcotic drug.
I should point out that's true throughout just about every section of this article. We've incorporated the two together. We
combine them both, yeah.
Anybody have any questions on 4?
No. I move we adopt it.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. 5.
5, I don't believe we've made any changes at all, except I believe in preliminary draft number 1 we used the language drug addicts, and that was changed to drug users.
Let me ask you, on subsection 2 it says which is used for the unlawful keeping or sale of narcotic or dangerous drugs.
Yeah, that language is taken from our existence.
What does keeping mean?
Storage or
possessing. Are there any cases on that?
You don't get any cases on this because it's a cop-out. It's almost, as a practical matter, it's almost impossible to prove because of the word frequent. And that's what I got to...
Case law says frequent means more than one time, doesn't it?
Yeah, it depends. At
it
least
doesn't
more
mean
than
frequent
one
in
time.
A body house, though, with once enough in a gambling house.
I don't think
house,
so. I think there's some case law that says frequent means that it's more than once.
Yeah, we've tried a couple of them down there, and on one of them, at least, we got a hung jury out of it, and the other, we couldn't get that far on the frequenting. And so all it's used for is a reduced plea. Unless you've got a situation where you've got an officer that's been sitting on the place for 3 or 4 days watching the person go in and out of it.
Isn't frequent in the present statute?
Yeah, and that's what makes it impossible to use it for prosecution. I mean, you use it for a reduced plea.
That's a handy cop-out section, though, isn't it?
Also, I got a question that under the present statute also includes vehicle. And
I had a case that came in like that the other day. Something about unlawfully frequenting a vehicle where marijuana was kept or something. And I
we've had several pleas to that. Like where we find a group in a car.
Of course,
smoking.
That's only once. Now, that's only once. You don't.
Yeah, but it's a plea to it. Prosecuting them would be different. I mean, it's a cop-out. It's a plea. They were in the car smoking. We had one of them with the possession of the baggie, and the rest of them, we prosecuted him for possession, but the rest of them... pled to, well, in fact, I think in that particular case, all of them, we let plead to frequenting a vehicle where narcotic drugs are illegally kept and used. But it's always, like I say, we tried two of them and got the closest we got was a hung jury.
Please don't say hung jury. I'm very sensitive about that.
Put in a vehicle, we ought to put in a boat, I suppose, in an airplane.
Well, the present statute includes a vehicle, boat, or aircraft.
Bicycle.
Because subsection 3 of the present statute says no person shall frequent any place if he knows it to be a place of the type described in subsection 1. And that describes a number of different types of places, warehouses, etc., than vehicle, boat, or aircraft. Or any place, whatever.
We get into the situation with this statute, and we got into the discussion last time here, that where you come in, say, a place where they're all, not all, but there's the odor of the marijuana, or whatever it is, the stronger you got them, all are with their needles and syringes and speed like we had in one situation. I mean, you can see that being in the place there probably bad for anybody. But yet you get the situation that Don was talking about where attending some party or something someplace and apparently upstairs in one of the rooms that there was some pot smoking going on. That raises a different question, but it seems to me that if we want it for a statute to prosecute on, that the frequent ought to be changed to being in. And that, or something similar to that, rather than the word frequent.
I believe that's the language employed in the statute on body houses, found in or about, rather than frequently.
Mm-hmm. Because
do you ever use this thing?
We probably would have used it after the Orr case. It becomes more important to have a statute like this to use. Because under the Orr case, it comes almost to the point, unless the person's got it in their hand, you're not going to be able to charge them with anything. So that this statute would probably be a usable statute.
I don't really like statutes like this. Bug me.
Well, it would be a statute that could be used to clean out the... They don't have them anymore, but almost into the opium den type of situation that you run into on occasion, where this is a place where you're congregating.
Maybe you could solve it by by writing in some language that frequenting means more than once, unless there's, let's say, some combination of circumstances.
What about this, saying that being in the place, knowing...
It's already in there, knowingly. Knowingly.
What about the soch prof that is actually in there observing something with no intent to do any criminal act?
He's there and knows, and that's why he's there, because he does know.
You're doing research.
I do research in all kinds of things.
He's taking his chances on his research in that.
What if he's researching a body house?
Mm-hmm. But I would think that
maybe he is.
The number Don's situation, like some smoking going on up in another room where a legitimate party is going on downstairs, that the person would have to know that it's being used or know that it is kept there. So I think that just being there, where it's being used, if you know that it's being used, it should come within this statute. I mean, it's...
They probably don't do things like that in Corvallis, but it's getting to Portland, you can go to a party, and people can disappear off into various rooms and be smoking pot and reappear.
They disappear to other rooms not to smoke pot.
Depends on
if
you're back or not. As you get older, I guess you're... You're not taking minutes, are you?
Every minute, every word.
Clean up your language.
Yeah. I might note that this... does expand existing law because it includes dangerous drugs for the present.
Yeah.
Or as 474.130.
I would move we change this language of frequency to the body house language.
A person who knowingly maintains or is found in or about.
Now this section is as was approved by the subcommittee on December 11th, which time Mr. Knight replied that the term frequency used in the section would provide an individual with a defense if he were in the home just the one time.
He was going to be consistent, Frank.
Yeah.
Well, at least it points out that this bothers me every time I come up.
Right. We'll have the minutes show that.
I move we adopt it.
I've already got a motion.
There's a motion on the floor to to amend, to remove frequent and insert the appropriate language in and about. Knowingly maintains or
is found in or about.
Boy, that gives you a carte blanche for somebody's got one roach and you wipe out the entire group.
Well, one problem seems to be you've got knowingly maintained, but then as to being found in or about, there's really no culpability as it applies if you're found in or about a place where narcotics are kept.
Well, yeah, I'd say the first thing to me should be something they have to know, and the circumstances would have to be such that they knew, like being in a room and some narcotics or danger drugs being in a drawer somewhere with no proof that they knew anything about it being there. I mean, that shouldn't be a violation.
All those in favor of Frank Knight's motion will say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No. Chip Frank, maybe? How'd that feel?
There go the doves again.
I move we adopt the section.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Carried.
I can count, Frank. I can count.
Sometimes I question that, Dave, but this time...
No, I don't think. I just count.
Section 6.
You say you could count.
Section
correctly.
6.
Yeah.
I believe we made some language changes. Subsection 3, the use or giving of a false name or a false address. And subsection 4. Falsely representing himself to be a manufacturer.
Is there a problem, Roger, with other authorized person? Other authorized person, authorized to do what?
To lawfully obtain a drug, that's what we mean. Or, well, we have to look back at the top. If a person, if he obtains it or procures the administration of a narcotic or dangerous drug. In other words, your question would be what person would be authorized to do so that we don't have listed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, wouldn't 474 or 475 specify those who are in fact authorized?
Yes. Procures the administration, of course, would apply to a patient.
Why, it wouldn't be easier to simply say false representing himself to be a person authorized by law to obtain dangerous or narcotic drugs?
Well,
go away from the listing?
Well,
because all of these people are authorized by statute to obtain and dispense it. The thing that bothers me, we're in the lists again, and we put an all-inclusive tag on it.
I don't like the language either, but what about the latter phrase that procures the administration? Of course, does that really apply before?
Yeah, this is a restatement of the present statute, which says no person shall obtain a narcotic drug or procure to procure the administration of a narcotic drug.
But why would a manufacturer, wholesaler, apothecary, physician, dentist, veterinarian, or other authorized person be getting a fix? None of those people are in the business of being administered to.
But a patient.
Yeah.
Well, I assume that as to sub 4, it applies primarily to the language obtained.
Yes,
so
I'm sure it does.
Obtaining it.
Would there be any problem with taking the list out and putting by falsely representing himself to be a person authorized by law to obtain? It doesn't apply to administration. Am I right?
No, because the other subsections really apply to...
Well, you have to redraft it then.
Oh, maybe it's not all that important, really, is it?
Well, we don't really say what an authorized person is. I mean, it's probably pretty clearly implicated.
It means a person authorized by law to obtain, I think.
Yeah, but I could say, well, I'm...
Well, if we use Dave's language, falsely representing him itself to be a, it still wouldn't take him to procure, would it? How could he procure the administration by falsely representing?
I don't think it applies.
I don't think it applies to falsely portray the administration.
The only one that we haven't covered, maybe, is the stake or the the bait in a trap.
Why don't we put? Why don't we change it so it reads: a person commits
Well, I think we just limit sub 4 to obtaining. As a person authorized by law to obtain. Narcotic code.
Well, you'd have to do some drafting changes there, Roger. I don't know how you do it. What you could do is put it in above, if he obtains narcotic or dangerous drug by falsely representing himself to be, and then, or maybe sub 2, obtains or procures narcotic drug by 1, 2, 3, and 5.
Another thing also is, what is subterfuge? Does it have a legal definition? Fraud, deceit, misrepresentation do, yeah, I know. But I think fraud, deceit, misrepresentation are all definable. But a subterfuge...
Yeah, if you look up subterfuge,
well, subterfuge would be anything...
Fraud, deceit, misrepresentation.
Beautiful.
Well, why don't we avoid subterfuge and take it out?
That's what I was thinking. But or, after
well,
deceit and misrepresentation.
That's good subterfuge.
What?
Yeah, we were being a little super cautious in this because of the...
Because of Representative Frost's...
we wanted to be sure we had the existing law, you know, but...
Well,
I don't care.
Why don't we change so as to make it fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation? Everybody recognizes it includes subterfuge.
Yeah, and fraud, deceit, misrepresentation are words that we've used elsewhere in the code, but I don't recall us using subterfuge anyplace else.
Do we want to just leave 4 alone, or do you want to try to redraft?
Well, why don't we have Roger redraft it so as to show that 4 is applicable to obtains?
Okay.
Is that okay, Frank? John?
This won't take a going back to the subcommittee, though, will it?
No.
Well, if you made the change that Dave suggested, I don't think you've heard it any. I don't think we want to try to split this up into subsections and make part of it obtaining and part of it procuring. Mm-hmm. I don't think you really accomplish anything by that except to complicate the structure. And so applies to obtains. I don't think that hurts it any.
I don't think so either. It's impossible to prosecute under administration anyway,
yeah,
so it has to be obtained.
Well, then you'd suggest changing 4 to be...
Just false represents himself to be a person authorized by law to obtain
narcotics
or dangerous drugs.
Yeah. Don't you think that would do what you want to do without...
All in favor of that change, say aye.
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 Opposed?
Move it up.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Carried.
That's the first time one vote's carried.
Prima facie evidence. I have a question on Section 1. Have you checked Section 1 against the Leary case?
No.
And there's a case that just came down yesterday or this week in which they held the presumption of heroin okay, but they didn't hold the presumption of
cocaine.
I think. Mm-hmm. They threw out the cocaine presumption. Yeah. Apparently, it's a little hard to tell.
That turned on a presumption that, for example, the cocaine and heroin were imported.
Yeah, that just having possession with prima facie knowledge that you knew had been
unlawfully imported. But it seems to me the Leary case goes beyond that.
Well, the on marijuana, the Leary case would seem to go beyond it, although that was dealing with marijuana or something rather than heroin. So when they got heroin up there, they said that's perfectly all right because
it's all
so
important.
Far as we know, there is no growth of, what is it, it's
opium poppies, yeah.
Opium poppies in the United States, at least not sufficient to have any manufacture of heroin, so that the possession of heroin still is. You still do have the prima facie knowledge that it's imported. So, I mean, they're not throwing out prima facie knowledge, they're just simply throwing out that in the case of marijuana, there's so much grown here in the United States that that this would be an incorrect presumption anymore. Not that the law is wrong, but times have changed.
Well, I would, Roger.
But I will check those two cases.
Go to the commission. I think you ought to check those cases to make sure. Why do we limit it to manufacture, cultivation, transportation, and possession? How about sale?
Well, it hasn't been felt that you require that presumption on a sale, because it would be no question that a person selling a narcotic or dangerous drug.
Well, how would this apply? You say proof of unlawful possession is prima facie evidence of knowledge of its character. Now, how do you prove unlawful possession? Don't you prove possession knowing possession?
In other words, if you've got a tablet in your pocket that when tested turns out to be LSD, then it would be up to you the state wouldn't have to actually prove that you knew it was LSD. If you knew, they'd only have to prove that you knew you had that pill in your pocket.
Well, suppose I had a marijuana cigarette in my pocket right here and now, which I don't. Check.
You just look.
Suppose I had that. That would be, maybe that'd be prima facie evidence of knowledge of its character, but it says proof of unlawful possession. And the crime itself in Section 2 is knowingly and unlawfully possessing.
No, that's a good point. Our present statute on dealing in narcotics, possession statute, doesn't use words of culpability. It doesn't have the element of knowing. So it should be unlawful for any person to possess narcotics.
Of course, they always throw in...
knowing is there.
Willfully and feloniously into the indictment for whatever they have.
But what this does is it means that the state does not have to prove that you knew that it was LSD that had been rather than speed or STP or something else. I mean, you knew you had that pill. I mean, like, in other words, they wouldn't have to prove that you knew that that was marijuana. All they'd have to do is prove you knew you had that cigarette in your pocket.
Do you have to prove it now?
Sure, you got to prove knowing possession.
Well, now, wait a minute. How do you prove it now? Suppose you got a marijuana possession case, you bring on the officer who says, yeah, I arrested him and found marijuana in his pocket. You bring on the guy from the lab who's positive for marijuana, and you're the jury, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
Is there any showing there that the defendant knew that it was marijuana?
No, I don't think there is, and I think that's why we put this in here, because under this draft, now you've got to show knowledge. You've got to show at least some culpability element that isn't required under your present statutes. So to help get you halfway to the home plate, we put in these prima facie evidence provisions on with respect to knowledge.
Particularly with drugs other than marijuana.
Well, I take it that what you're saying then is proof of unlawful possession would be
proof that you had the cigarette in your pocket.
Is proof of knowing possession. It's prima facie evidence of a knowing possession. In other words, that you understood that what you possessed was marijuana.
Yeah, subsection 1 of section 7 then would satisfy the culpability element of knowing in section 2.
But it becomes unlawful, I take it, when I have it rather than a doctor or a research scientist. Isn't that what you're talking about? I mean, if a Providence Hospital got all the heroin in the world, you know, but I don't have it, if I had it, then that'd be unlawful possession.
Why don't we just, Frank, if these bother you, let's just take them all out. The prima facie evidence.
They don't bother me at all.
But under Section 2, under Section 2, the district attorney is going to have to allege and prove that you knowingly and unlawfully possessed a dangerous drug, to wit, whatever it happens to be. Mm-hmm. So, which he doesn't have to prove now. You don't have to prove that you, that your defendant knew that what he had was LSD or marijuana.
Well,
you just prove possession.
Under the instructions that our court gives, they say that you got to find that he knowingly had marijuana or whatever it is in his possession.
Well,
and,
it has to be,
and then it becomes a matter of the defense arguing that he didn't know that he had that in his pocket.
That goes to the question of knowledge of the possession rather than knowledge of the character of the item.
Knowledge of the possession, and of course, we had in one case, I mean, the argument made that we hadn't shown that this person knew that these 18 packets that he had in this little cigarette case were speed. And that we proved that he knew that he had them in his pocket, but we hadn't proven that he knew that they were speed.
Yeah, right, but he knew they were there.
And, of course, I mean, it was a, and the argument was also made to the jury, I mean, that we hadn't proven, of course, the court's instruction that he knowingly possessed methamphetamine. And so they were arguing that we, they'd argued to the court, and then they argued to the jury, but I mean, it didn't get them anywhere, but...
What you want to do is write a statute to prevent the making of these outrageous arguments.
No,
I
just want to have a statute that prevents the court, the trial court, from making an outrageous ruling had the judge bought the weak argument that he made, you see.
But even with these prima facie evidence provisions, your defendant is still getting a better break under these statutes than he would now as far as proof of possession is concerned.
Why don't you look at me, Doug?
No, I just...
There goes one vote.
I have to look at somebody.
There goes one vote.
We have to bring it up.
I do have one suggestion. In sub 3, I think we should change the word pharmacist to apothecary just to be consistent.
Oh, good idea.
We can make a pharmacist or apothecary.
That's an idea we defined.
Jar. You know. I didn't know it was a.
Yeah, some of the drafting looks too.
Any further discussion of Section 7?
No, we adopt it. Well, I might point out that Subsection 2 is somewhat of a radical change in existing law. That circumstance now is a crime, a felony. Put it in terms of the prima facie evidence.
Where it ought to be.
Yeah. All in favor of Section 7, say aye.
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 Opposed?
Carried.
Section 8 on page 15, there's no changes.
That's the one that places the burden on the defendant to get under a provisional
exception.
Is that
a no change, or doesn't the one say any, does it just say prosecution, or doesn't it say indictment? In any indictment, such and such.
You mean from the our present?
Yeah, the present statute.
Does the present law say indictment?
Well,
that's a good idea.
Indictment, complaint.
Oh, to wash some of these things out on preliminary hearings.
This language here is, I'm sure, is different than existing law, because this is standard language we've used throughout our drafting for stating defenses or exceptions.
Let me see.
Have we been using the series of words exception, excuse, provisional,
no,
exemption,
we have not.
This proviso, or exemption?
No, we haven't.
And that's
right out of your present statute. No, we haven't used all that stuff.
Couldn't we say exception, exemption, or justification?
10474, it's not...
It says, in any complaint, information, or indictment, in any action or proceeding brought for the enforcement of any provision of the chapter.
Yeah, that's what I thought. It makes it more specific that you don't have to negative in the... So, I think we should make it clear that if we say in any prosecution, we do not intend to change the present language of complaint, information, or indictment.
No, I don't see. Well, how? I don't see that we are.
Okay.
Would this apply to a forfeiture proceeding? See, the present statute says any proceeding to enforce any provision. I would think if we make the defendant carry the ball on a proviso or exception, we ought to do it on a Section 9 forfeiture as well, shouldn't we?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that's what the present law is.
Mm-hmm.
Any objection if we have Roger change Section 8 so as to make it applicable to prosecutions or to forfeitures as well?
The only thing comment I would have is I don't like the forfeiture provision anyway, and I hate to tie it to Section 8 yet. But
man, what is the pleasure of the group?
I think I would move that we have it apply to Section 9.
All in favor of Frank's motion to apply Section 8 to Section 9 will say aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye. No.
Carried.
How about the use of the words exception, excuse, proviso, or exemption? I guess that's nitpicking, but... Well, it's not standard in what we've been doing so far, but it's in the present law. It doesn't make a difference.
No, it's... Of course, we were charged with the responsibility of doing as little of this as we could.
Who was that? All right.
That's what we get the name every time.
Oops. All in favor of Section 8?
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Section 9.
What on earthly reason is there for having a forfeiture of a vehicle? The same as forfeiting a firearm and the hunting statutes, and it doesn't do any good.
Yeah, it does. Should
some DA drive a Cadillac around for a while?
No, that's probably one change we ought to make in the statute is to the procedure that's followed in the sale.
Have it as cheap to the DA?
Yes. For the... Shall be sold or used for investigation, prosecution, the statute, you see.
Like the liquor control fund.
Yeah.
Liquor enforcement control.
The federal law has a provision for forfeiture also, and this is a note by Henry Giardino, who's a...
Well, he was commissioner of narcotics.
And he says that it's an important facility for Thus, an important facility for narcotic peddling is taken from the violator and becomes a facility on the side of the law. Because he says, after forfeiture, some of these vehicles are used in enforcement work, in investigation, detection, and arrest of other violators.
Narcotics buys no cars at all.
They use all?
Yeah, that's right.
Vehicles?
They have no appropriation to buy vehicles, federal narcotics.
Why don't we take away the belt for his pants, too? Because <that's crazy. laughs>
Puncture his lungs?
Yeah, that's a thought.
Puncture his lungs.
Cut out his tongue.
And on theft, let's take the fingers, check right at your fingers.
We can brand the scarlet N on his forehead. That has good historical precedent.
I have one question. You've discussed this somewhat in the article, in the commentary. On its face, I don't think it's constitutional.
We thought you might.
You mean the warrantless search?
Yeah.
Well, there's quite a few people today questioning whether it's constitutional.
Except your commentary suggests that by construction they can say so construe it to mean that, if it isn't a reasonable search,
do you?
Then it's no good anyway. So I suppose maybe that's okay, but it just sort of offends me to pass a statute that in terms at least, is just flat out unconstitutional.
Yeah, William Fry in the Oregon Criminal Law Handbook, 1969,
all right,
he intimates that he feels it might be unconstitutional.
Okay, the United States Supreme Court has considered a search on this. I know you don't have it cited, Cooper versus California, but I had decided to the Court of Appeals the day before yesterday. A case out of California where the car had been seized under this statute. The search actually took place about a week later, and it was based on partially on this statute that because they had the car seized, they found narcotics being transported in it, they had arrested the defendant, impounded the car, and then about a week later, the car was searched, and in the glove box they found some paper or something that I don't really recall how important and how relevant this was to the case, but they upheld the search and seizure 1 week after the arrest based upon this statute, the similar statute of California.
Of course, in that case they had a duty to take the car into custody for safekeeping, and that was part of the rationale.
Well, but they said that the state doesn't have to wait until after that car has been forfeited before they search it. They can go ahead and search it at any time that they have it. This is one of the things, that Judge Fort raised in this argument last Tuesday, is whether or not this statute is constitutional or not.
Well,
but the defendant didn't raise it, and he wasn't prepared to get the argument.
The other cases, though, since Cooper, have shed some doubt, too, on just how strong Cooper is. Of course, I suppose if you say reasonable information, that's the equivalent of probable cause under the Fourth Amendment, you don't have any problem. But,
I think that we're really dealing with a situation here where a vehicle is so mobile that they don't have time to go down and get a search warrant.
Frank, I'm surprised at you.
I just got to argue a case at the Court of Appeals probably going to reverse, but on a variety of grounds.
Well, yeah,
tremendously, of course.
Well, the way they were going at me, they didn't reverse on any ground. Jumping up and down. I've had them jump on
you're
me before,
get away
but not,
with this.
Not that bad. Problem
from all sides and all the way through.
Well, can't we at least say something pious, like we don't intend to violate the Fourth Amendment by passing this?
We prefer not to. It's not the intent of the committee to violate the Fourth Amendment.
At least not the intent of some of the members of the subcommittee.
Yeah.
Yes, let's word it that way.
I don't think that'll save it.
No, I think we can sit back and be afraid of what the courts might do to it. I mean, there is a statute now that does this, and so if the courts are going to do it, they're going to do it, and let's not us do it for them.
No, I think Frank's right.
Separation of powers.
Yeah, right.
Because they're,
you
know,
have something to do
reasonable with men can differ on this section,
I also
is that pious enough?
I like that.
I also have a little bit of a sticking in my craw. The last sentence: he shall also, without delay, make and file a complaint for any crime justified by the evidence obtained. And that's really low to dog.
Fruit of the poison tree.
Because it says he shall arrest any person in charge of the conveyance and take the arrested person before the court. Well, but if he doesn't obtain enough evidence to justify filing something, what's he going to do when he gets the arrested person in front of the JP?
Probably
file weekly and say, hi, fellas.
Well, yeah, that last sentence there really doesn't add anything, does it?
Of course, that's from the present statute, isn't it?
It's probably going to be the parking lot attendant anyway. Well, this is a really a beautiful work right here.
You like it?
Yeah, this is almost verbatim.
Since we were
present standard.
Since we were supposed to do as little violence as possible.
I know.
All in favor, section 9?
Aye.
I'll vote aye. All opposed?
No.
I abstain.
Carry.
There we go again.
Section 10.
No changes for me. Section 10.
I move to adopt section 10.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Are you in favor?
Yes.
Okay. Carry.
I take it now this completes the narcotics. I got one thing that I'd like to raise before we finish.
I have one thing too.
Narcotics. And that is that on the quantity of narcotics required before you come within the prohibition of the statute. The reason why I bring it up today is because I argued it Tuesday, and I argued that this is for the legislature to decide, not the courts. And on the quantity, in this particular case, the defendant had requested an instruction that the jury had to find that there was sufficient quantity of the drug there for the use of which it's commonly put to it. Now, I understand you had a ruling in Multnomah County that
it was my case.
Quantity
taking
has,
it up.
Has nothing to do with it. Well, it may be decided already in this case by the time they get that one up, because we did have a small quantity, although we did add testimony that there was sufficient to put it in a pipe and smoke it. So I suppose we could go back and retry it on that issue and still do it. But there wasn't the instruction on it, which they had requested. And various states have ruled on the question, and primarily Texas has ruled that there has to be a sufficient quantity of the drug there for the use that it's commonly put to.
Has to be enough to sell or to make a fix or whatever.
Yeah, or what have you. I mean, you still have the situation like in the case that I had where he was saving a roach. I mean, you're not going to save it unless he's going to add it to others to eventually make it.
The case I had was where the all that was in the spoon was a residue, enough to be identified. Well, it was in not in a spoon. It was in the cotton, you know, that goes along with it. And Oscar's taking it up.
Yeah.
We're going to get a ruling on it.
But the reason why I bring it up now is that I think it is for the legislature for us to decide, rather than the court to decide. So I would feel that, of course, I have my own personal feelings on it, but I would feel that the commission should make a decision on that issue one way or the other and have it in here. We either say that there has to be a sufficient quantity there for it to be put to its use, or that we say that it does not, because there are places that I know there are seven states that have ruled that you don't have to have that much, that even a modicum is sufficient, and there are about three or four states who have ruled the other way on the same statute that we have. And I feel that it's for the legislature to say, not the courts.
But
so
Frank, have any of the states reached a legislative solution? Haven't the results in fact been reached by the court, by court construction?
Yes, but
then why do we need to write it in?
Well, because the courts that say that you don't have to have a sufficient quantity, the basis of their opinions is basically that had the legislature intended that there be any certain quantity, they would have said that there has to be a certain amount. The courts that rule that there has to be a sufficient quantity to use commonly put to it say that the legislature did not intend that it's the using of it that is harmful. I mean, in other words, the courts are saying what the legislature intended, regardless of what their ruling is. And so why don't we say what we intend rather than having the Supreme Court later decide what we meant when we don't say.
Well, may I make a suggestion? Why don't you prepare a little tiny paragraph and present it to the commission? I think it's a policy decision for the commission.
Okay.
Don?
I just wanted to mention and have the record show that while I voted for a number of these articles, that I still feel that offenses involving narcotics and dangerous drugs, particularly the use thereof or the possession for one's use, are inappropriately handled by a criminal law sanction and more appropriately handled in a medical social model, and that I recognize the realities that one state probably cannot adopt this by itself and it'll have to be done on a broader scale, probably at a national level, but I still think that it's self-defeating and helps promote the use of and abuse of drugs.
Very good. Now we come to firearms. Sorry these folks had to wait so long.
Now, Mr. Chairman, these two individuals who have been waiting so patiently are Mrs. Perry, who's chairman of the Gun Control Committee of the Kennedy Action Corps, and Mr. Finn, who's a member of that committee. As I advised you earlier, I had been contacted by Mr. Cormack some time past, and he had requested an opportunity for them to appear before the commission to present their views on gun control whenever we got to that subject. So they were advised that the subcommittee was going to be taking up this draft today. And so they have prepared and submitted in advance some written materials which appear before you in the blue binders with respect to gun control firearms legislation. And I invited Mrs. Perry and Mr. Finn to wait, and if they wanted to make a verbal statement to the subcommittee, they have an opportunity to do so.
Well, why don't we start with you folks, in particular since we made you wait this long. I don't think any of us thought that we were all going to be so meticulous about the narcotic law. Why don't you
might mention due to the fact that we've been through it three times already. Doesn't sound very good on the face of it.
Due to the fact
we don't really care about narcotics.
Representative Frost was persuasive in the...
All right. Put me down.
So why don't you start in, Ms. Perry?
Okay, well, we have been sitting here listening to your discussion of laws relating to the sale and use of dangerous drugs, and there obviously are a great many regulations passed by the Oregon legislature in this matter. The Oregon legislature has passed some laws dealing with regulating the sale and use of firearms, but they're very few, and we feel they're absolutely inadequate to control the sale and use of firearms, and we feel it's a very negligent attitude because these are lethal weapons, and the state has no comprehensive plan for trying to prevent any crime used with guns. We feel the state condones misuse of firearms by not having any restrictions against potentially dangerous users of firearms. There is a law that for registration of handguns, and there is a law that prohibits aliens and convicted felons from owning firearms. Of course, that doesn't do any good to just prohibit people from using firearms. There's no way of enforcing such a prohibition. And there are no laws at all about long guns. If you're a criminal or fugitive from justice, you may legally possess and use a long gun. We feel this is very incongruous if there's laws regulating the use of drugs, which I don't even think would be quite as dangerous as a firearm. There should be laws regulating firearms, and the state has the power to regulate one, and has the power to regulate the other. Now, I can answer questions from you. Compiled a lengthy report. We think it's a very well-documented argument for gun control laws. I'm sorry I didn't get it to you in time so you could read it before the meeting, and I hope you will read it, because a year's work's going into it. And today I'd like to concentrate on what Oregon's laws are and the proposals we have to support comprehensive gun control law for the state.
How would you change them?
How would I change them? Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I would have a licensing law. If you're interested in prevention of crime, I think this is the keystone of any preventive program. It would be an identification card or some sort of permit that one would apply for if one wanted to buy or possess any sort of firearm. They would apply to the State Department of Police. They would be investigated through fingerprints, photo, name check. All this information would be on the application, and the applicant would swear that he was not among certain prohibited classes of people that the legislature would deem ineligible for responsible gun use. These people would be narcotics addicts, alcoholics, mentally incompetent people, imbeciles, juveniles, or whoever the legislature thought to be irresponsible when it came to guns. This would be investigated, this application would be investigated, and if the person passed the investigation and was not found to fall into any of these classes of people, he would get a license, and with that license he could possess or purchase any number of guns.
This would be an individual license rather than a license for the weapon itself.
Yes, this would be just a license allowing him to purchase or possess.
Like a driver's license.
Yeah. And this would be applicable to all sorts of transfers, whether the man, the gun owner, wanted to buy a gun at a store, to a licensed dealer, or whether he wanted to buy from a private party, or whether it was a gift. And able to be able to transfer or to receive a firearm at all, you would have to be a holder of such a permit. It could be renewed every 5 years and be reinvestigated. And there would be some process of judicial review in case, so there would be no arbitrary, you know, these would not be given out arbitrarily or withheld for arbitrary reasons. We also advocate a system of registration of firearms because we feel that anyone who owns a firearm has to be legally responsible for it. And if that firearm ends up being used in a crime, or stolen or lost, a registration with a gun serial number, one would be able to trace it to police or whoever could trace the gun back to the owner, for the owner. We feel that these laws should apply to all firearms and ammunition. They should apply to all transfers. And they should apply to all firearms, whether they are just being newly purchased or whether they're in possession, whether they're being already in somebody's possession. The laws we have now do not apply to guns in one's possession. You register handguns that are bought, but we do not register handguns or long guns that are already possessed. So the licensing and registration laws would apply to guns currently in possession.
You register handguns under what city ordinance?
State statute.
State.
Well, you have to. That's what the seller, the dealer.
Oh, the dealer, yeah.
Yeah, the dealer registers.
The sale is made.
And the purchaser has to sign a registration form, gets the correct information. But we just feel that there are no laws now that protect the public from any sort of gun misuse. Anybody, and as I said, a fugitive from justice can legally buy a gun. He's in no way prevented from doing so. And we feel there should be some laws to protect every citizen from gun misuse. And there's plenty of gun misuse in the state nationally. It's well documented that there's a big deal of gun misuse, and that the guns used in the great majority of murders and armed robberies. And in this climate of violence, which gets more and more violent, we just think it's idiotic not to have any such laws.
Mr. Finn?
Well, I was just like to say that I don't believe that this subject has been given serious consideration. I'm not positive of the way it's been handled in Oregon, except to see what's, you know, we have a list of Oregon laws. And I can see, you know, myself, the times I've looked over the laws here, loopholes, that to me don't look like anybody's given the same consideration you've given the drug laws here today. For instance, one point that disturbs me when we discuss gun control is that people say, well, the criminals can always get guns no matter how anyway, all the licensing systems in the world. But today, there's a flagrant way of doing it as it stands now. You don't have to, if I wanted to get a gun and I were a criminal or I were insane, I could get it from a friend, and the friend would be under no obligation to the laws of the state of Oregon to, he could not be punished. I could hand out guns to anybody. There's no legislation, no serious legislation that could stop me from doing this. And I think that the licensing system we've been thinking of working on, which is in effect in one form or another in other states, and which we've gone even to the trouble of working out the pricing for and the source of income, could prevent the misuse of the guns, the exchange of guns between the criminally insane or the criminal element and the regular citizen. And I think that the program we've worked out will in no way restrict anybody that who has a legitimate use for a gun, hunters, or those people that are, for one reason or another, want a gun, need a gun. Yet it will, we feel, be one good step. It's only on the local level, the state of Oregon, but it is one step. We feel a big step, and we'd be very proud of the state of Oregon if we could get this much passed, this licensing.
What other states have similar legislation or portions of this legislation?
Massachusetts has a licensing, very strict licensing law.
New Jersey.
New Jersey, Illinois, New York.
Are they, would they be similar to House Bill 1546, for example? Do you know?
Well, we have a wonderful book here that was just published. It's a staff report to the Violence Commission. It was a special task force report to the Violence Commission on firearms, the relation of firearms and violence. And there is a thing in the back that describes all state laws, what they do and what they do not do. And it's impossible to remember them because...
Do you have that?
This particular,
yeah.
No, we don't.
You should have that. It's I just sent my copy to Jim.
Yeah.
I think it's $1.25 for the printing office, and it's, it should be looked at.
It's really, I haven't had the chance to do any more than just scan it, but it looks like a very comprehensive study.
It's very comprehensive. There's lots of new studies that were done, commissioned by scientific research teams from universities that really try to establish some sort of scientific relationship between firearms and violence. And I think does a good job doing that. I mean, they didn't go in with the idea that they would. That was the result of their studies. And we just feel that it's just criminal not to have any laws like this in Oregon.
Let me ask you this. Did you you folks make a presentation to the legislature on House Bill 1546?
No, our bill was never heard. They took. They said they would give us a hearing, but at the at the conclusion of the hearing, they would table the bill. No one was willing to consider it. It's a politically sensitive issue, and nobody's willing to even seriously consider the matter.
Which committee was it?
Fish and Game.
Sent right there to no business there. We wrote Robert Smith and said, please, this is a human bill. It's not a fish bill. And this is about the welfare and safety of humans. And, of course, was sent there to be killed because of the feeling against it by a minority of people. After the Kennedy assassination, the most recent one, we collected 32,000 signatures in 6 weeks. The signatures were addressed to Congress and the Oregon legislature demanding gun control laws. And that didn't impress the committee because no one would consider it. It was too frightening. And I hope this committee does not have the same sort of political pressures, and I hope they will consider it with an open mind and decide on the merits of the legislation, the kind of legislation we would propose.
I think one of the most important things is the bibliography in the back of this. It's a, I believe, you know, Margo has done most of the work in this, and this, it's a tremendous collection of the latest up-to-date statistics on firearms use and misuse, and what other states are doing. The constitutionality of it in Oregon is quite well presented. Who was it that the lawyer that?
Yes, well, I did the research on it, and Norm Linstead looked it over for us and proved it. And there have been two cases that I know of that have, in the Oregon Supreme Court, which have upheld the constitutionality of firearms laws. And this, the court has declared that this does not infringe on the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, nor does it infringe upon Article 1, Section 27 of the Oregon Constitution, which deals with the right to bear arms. So this is a prerogative of the state and the use of their police powers, and there's no reason why the state cannot regulate guns for the public's interest.
Now I noticed on page 34 of your report you have a list of strong gun law states and weak gun law states, and I recognize these are just for illustration purposes. How would you characterize Oregon? Where would Oregon fall? Would you characterize Oregon as a weak gun control state or somewhere in between, or where would we fall?
I would say it is no It has no controls at all. I mean,
well, we have more than Mississippi.
Yeah.
But we certainly have less than New Jersey.
It just, it in no way tries to deal with the sale and use of guns. It just says the handguns must be registered and that it prohibits selling guns to certain classes of people. Two classes, aliens, which I can never figure that out, why they would be dangerous to people.
Your book.
And convicted felons, and yet and there are no ways to enforce these restrictions. It doesn't require a permit or any investigation. It just prohibits these people. It's like saying murder is prohibited, but we shall not bring to justice anybody who murders. We just think that's a bad thing to do. Mm-hmm. And the same way with your drug laws. Your drug laws, you have ways of bringing people to justice. And this is a very simple permit system, the same thing as a driver's license. To certify that person is safe, don't a lethal weapon, and that's what guns are, deadly weapons in there.
Do you know if any of these strong gun law states have licensing and registration on long guns?
Illinois, this was taken from a book called Firearms Facts, which is put out by the Criminal Division of the Justice Department right after Robert Kennedy was assassinated. At that time, the Illinois law was not in effect. That requires a license for possession and purchase of long guns and handguns. The New Jersey one has special laws for handguns, a little bit different from their laws for long guns, but both are covered. New York requires a permit for the sale or possession, purchase or possession of handguns. It's a Sullivan law, and has just recently added registration laws for long guns. They do not have a permit system. Massachusetts has a permit system, I know, for handguns. I'm not sure. Just, you know, it's impossible to remember them all, but there are such laws in effect. And I think New York is a very good example. You know, with all the crime in New York, one would think that they have a very high gun murder rate. And in fact, they have a very low overall murder rate and a very low percent of murders committed with a gun. I think it's 39% or something, whereas, no, I have it here someplace, whereas, most nationally, the average of percent of murders committed with guns is 65%, and going up each year, by the way. And New York, because they have what is called a restrictive licensing system, which we are not advocating. We are advocating what's called a permissive licensing system, which would allow anyone to have a permit to purchase their own unrestricted amount of guns if they did not fall into certain prohibited classes. But a restrictive licensing system requires that a person prove a need for a gun. And that's what the Sullivan Law is, especially in New York City. And their investigations in New York City last up to 7 months, and the cost was something like $125 per license. And it's extremely tough and strict, but they have an extremely low overall murder rate in it and very low percentage of crimes committed with guns. So it does work.
How long has New York had the Sullivan Law? Do you recall?
Before World War II.
Yeah, since the 30s.
So is your proposal here substantially the same as House Bill 1546?
I think so. I'm not, you know, we've learned a lot. This was last year, and we've learned a lot with change of a few things. It's substantially the same. This does not include a provision about a waiting period between sale and delivery of a gun, which we recommend. But this does have licensing and registration in it. And it would be something like this. There are some good sample bills. We have a very good sample bill. I have with me this was for a city licensing and registration law. It was prepared by the National League of Cities and the United Conference of Mayors. And it's a very good, simple law, though I disagree with some of the things in it. Illinois is a very good, you know, this bill is very simple. It's something to that effect.
When did Illinois pass its law? Since Kennedy's
It was passed in about 1967. It just went into effect in July 68, so there hasn't been much reported on its effectiveness. All law enforcement officers seem to advocate strong gun control laws, and it seems they always have. The International Association of Chiefs of Police, J. Edgar Hoover, and all the presidential commissions, recent commissions, the crime commission, the violence commission, the Kerner commission, have all recommended strong laws. And they call the indiscriminate trafficking gun a major factor in lawlessness. And I think we're at a time when people are demanding law and order and how terrible all this violence is. And I think if we're going to be serious about dealing with violence, then we have to somehow contend with firearms and their place in violence. And I can't give you all the statistics now. I couldn't do it justice, but there's a long section here called "Are Firearms Really Needed?" And we go through all of those statistics, most of them taken from the Uniform Crime Reports, which is published by the FBI each year, and the number of gun murders and assaults keeps going up, and the percent of assaults and murders committed with a gun compared to other assaults committed without a gun keeps going up. Extremist groups are arming themselves. Suburban ladies are arming themselves what they're afraid of, people in the ghetto. And it's just the situation's getting worse and worse. And a lot of people just pretend not to notice it, because it does, especially in a state like Oregon, it's a politically sensitive issue.
Any further questions?
Well, I'd just like to mention at this time that I think there is sentiment on the whole commission for a change in direction in gun control in the state of Oregon. I think this has come out several different times. Secondly, I would say from my own position that what they're advocating does not go near far enough. And I would go a great deal further. And I think that people who have observed the urban scene and what's going on between various ethnic and cultural groups and the conflicts between those groups and between some of the political extremists, that we're going to have to either face confiscation of firearms in urban settings, or we're going to have the most bloody kind of civil wars imaginable. And I just think that it would be irresponsible for this commission to at this time ignore the facts of life of what's going on in our urban centers. And I think we have to deal with it. Now, if we should go to the full commission to make some policy statement before we get down to the nitty-gritty, that's fine. But what we have done here and what we're going to look at is our proposal. I don't even think so.